show that is a deep discussion on the most common topics that come up in a law office and how the system of law works right here in Cullman County. If you have a question about the law, give us a call here at the Live 95 studio at 256-737-9505. This program is made possible by the support of local Cullman attorney Melvin Hastings. Views and opinions presented on this show are not the views and opinions of Live 95 staff or management. You should independently verify information heard on this program yourself. And no lawyer on this show actually helped write that disclaimer. And now, here's your host for Understanding the Law, Big D, Daryl Netherly.
Good evening, good evening. This is Danielle with Live 95.5. I'm filling in for Big D tonight with Melvin Hastings. Hi, Melvin.
Hi, Miss Danielle. You're Big D tonight?
I'm Big D tonight.
The Big Danielle.
Can you hear now?
Yes, I can hear
you
just fine.
Good. All righty, gotcha. All right, welcome to the show. Call in lines 256-737-9505 with any legal question you have. What's been going on this week, Melvin?
We had Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, did you have a good time?
No. I cleaned up trees. I had these storms were pretty rough, Saturday night, I guess it was, early Saturday morning, and I had trees on my fences everywhere, so I've been cutting trees and putting up fences all weekend, but other than that, it was pretty fun.
I think at the peak of those storms, there's about 9,000 people without power in Cullman County.
Yes, I didn't realize how big of a deal it was, but yeah, there was a lot of trees on power lines and power posts broke everywhere. It was got to be a pretty good mess, especially up here in Vima where we live at. So.
Mm-hmm. We got a little bit of hail. And lots of lightning, but no tree damage or anything like that. But I had a guy call and cancel today because he has to clean up his trees out of his yard.
Oh, man, I'm going to tell you, yeah, you drive in Vermont, just drive on any of these roads, man, they're everywhere. There's trees. You know, if it's not the whole tree down, there's big branches, or if it's a split tree, one half of it's laying on the ground. So it's a little stormy.
Well, tonight we're going to talk about criminal law. I know our Understanding the Law and Law and Order bass song that we have, our intro song, is very interesting. I actually like it. I think it's good. But there's all kinds of criminal law and TV shows. So, Melvin, can you tell the viewers how a case proceeds through the criminal justice system?
Yeah, it seems like the crime shows are pretty. They took a hit. I don't even know which the first one was, but it kind of took off, and then everything just goes with it. You know, I mean, they've got shows with the, you know, it used to be just the trials, people like Matlocks and stuff like that that's interested in the trials of it. Now it's got to, you know, where you pull in all the other evidence and the forensics and then the criminal investigations of the case and stuff like that. But all the felony cases always ends up in a county court system. You know, misdemeanors, if it's in a city jurisdiction like Hansville City, then it can, Hansville or Cullman City, it can end up, you know, it can start there. Sometimes they end up in circuit court and counties, but most of them ends up in the county court system. And usually what happens is, if let's say you report a crime, but somebody's broke in your house, well, that's a burglary, that's a felony. So because it's a felony, you go to the police, you call the Cullman County Sheriff's Department. If it's the city of Cullman City Police or Hansville Police Department, they will do an investigation, do an instant report on it. Then if they think there's enough evidence there of who did it, they'll go to the DA's office and get a warrant, you know, and then that's how the case proceeds. Now, that's the majority of them. Most of them gets a warrant. The case gets assigned a district court case number. Like here in Cullman, that'll go in front of Judge Cheney if it's a felony. And then eventually, at some point, they'll get indicted on it, which, and then that's how the case kind of gets taken to circuit court at that point.
On the burglary you were talking about, will you explain the different types of burglary?
Yep, there's only 3 degrees of burglary. And all the criminal cases, it's first, second, third, and first being the most severe, third being the least severe of the cases. So like a burglary, third would be the least severe of a burglary, even though it's still a felony case. It's a Class C felony. A year and you can get a year and a day up to 10 years if you get convicted of it. That is remaining unlawfully in a dwelling. I mean, in a building. That's what makes it burglary third. So common things we see burglary third is breaking into sheds, breaking into people's barns, breaking into storage. I mean, storage buildings happens a lot. So if someone breaks into a storage building, then they're charged with burglary third. Burglary second means that you either are in a you're breaking into a dwelling, so you're breaking into someone's house, or you're breaking into a building, but you're using a weapon. You've injured people breaking into it, or injured someone going out of it. Actually, I think the code section says you're armed with explosives, which usually I don't think I've ever handled a case where somebody's armed with explosives, but that's the second degree. If you get convicted of that, that's 2 years to 20 years sentence. Class B felony. The most serious burglary is burglary first. It's a Class A felony. Same thing. It's kidnapping first, rape first, murder first, whatever else. I mean, you get the same sentence. It's 10 years to 99 or life. But burglary first means you're breaking into a dwelling, but someone's either injured or you're using a weapon to do it. You know, and there's some common things that well, I actually had a case, and I think we took it to the appeals court. I don't know if it's the case that they clarify the law on, but if a person breaks into someone's house and they steal a gun and they leave with a gun, they were getting charged with burglary first. And the statute states, now the statute cleared it up, but before it was kind of unclear, so if you stole a gun, you're automatically charged with burglary first, but the intent of the statute was you have to use that gun to help you out. You have to use that gun to either gain entry, or use that gun to leave the scene.
Mm-hmm. That makes
sense. If you just steal the gun, it's a theft. I mean, it's still a simple theft, and then, you know, you'd be burglary second degree. And that's serious. But, I mean, all the burglaries are serious, but when you get to 10 to 99 years, you know, you get something, get a sentence above 15 years, then you lose your good time. It's a violent crime. It's not just a property crime. You're going to do 80% of your time, so it is significant, you know. And for that person, I remember the case for that person. It was significant that we got it overturned and got it reduced to burglary second.
Well, and in Coleman County, I know in the last couple of years we've had lots and lots of burglaries.
Yes, there is a lot. There's burglaries, and then there's breaking and entering a vehicle. Burglary is the same. It's the same thing. It's breaking and entering a home or a building.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of cases of breaking and entering a vehicle, and I argue different sometimes with some of these cases. But there are people charged if a person walks by a vehicle, the window's down, and you reach inside that vehicle and you pick up a purse or a wallet and walk away with it, they get charged with breaking and entering a vehicle. I still think it's theft, because I think there are some old cases that says you have to break into the vehicle. If you have breaking and entering, you have to break into the vehicle. But I think Supreme Court's then come back and said, nope, you know, if you break the plane of that vehicle, if you're reaching inside of a vehicle that's not yours, then you can get charged for breaking and entering the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of them. And like I said, most burglaries, there are houses, but the majority I see is storage. They know people just go cuts locks off storage sheds or something and tries to... Okay, here's a good example, and I've seen this a bunch. Somebody rents a storage shed, don't pay for it, they put a lock on it or change locks on it so they can't get their goods out. All right, so this person goes over and says, hey, I'm going to go get my stuff out there, you know, even though maybe you hadn't paid for 6 months or whatever else. They're going to cut the lock off. You would think most people would realize that there's cameras on it everywhere.
And
so here they are on camera.
Trespassing also, even though you're stealing your own goods back.
Yeah, it still is a trespass, and a burglary is a trespassing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're trespassing into someone's property and getting it. So these people are getting what they think is rightfully theirs, and even though it may be their property, they're still breaking into these things to get it. So, and next thing you know, they're charged with charged with a burglary third, and they looking at going to jail. Or, you know, making a stupid decision.
Well, and a lot of the places do have surveillance and stuff like that. I know I had a friend, their store got broken into, and they used Facebook footage, off their cameras to be able to catch them and ask the community to please help. Well, boom, they had them nailed down.
And a lot of times it doesn't take no time because somebody's going to, if you see them, they post them on there, you're going to find them. Yeah. They get found. So.
So, all right. Where are we going now?
Well, you want to know what happens when... So let's say this person gets charged with burglary. So the procedure is they get arrested, they get a bond set, and bonds are usually set by the magistrates up in the clerk's office. Judges sometimes set them. But they're usually set, and most of the time, in reality, it's the recommendation of the police officer. You know, it may be a $5,000, $10,000, whatever bond. And a lot of times it's property. Here lately, they have done a lot of cash bonds. Most of the time it's property bonds, so those people will get out of jail, they post property, or get someone to come sign for their property, or they hire a bail bondsman and pay them a fee. Then they get out of jail, get a court date, it's the initial appearance or the call docket. And what happens is you appear in front of a judge, like I said, here in Coleman, it's Judge Cheney, and he says, you know what you're charged with, you understand your charges, and do you have a lawyer, you're going to be able to hire one. If they're charged with a felony, they're going to get a lawyer. They automatically get one. If they have to fill out the forms and show they don't have enough money or assets to hire one, once they get an appointed attorney, then they can have what's called a preliminary hearing. If they want one, you have to request it. File a motion requesting and writing. And what happens in that case is the judge will hear the evidence the state has and then make a decision. Hey, is there enough information here? It's not if you're guilty or not guilty. Is there enough evidence here? Is there enough information that I have to send this to a grand jury and let them decide on this? And most of the time, the answer is yes, there is enough evidence. He just, most time district judges all over always send it to a grand jury. I mean, it'd be a rare situation where they would not send it to a grand jury. And then you won't ever know it. You never know when your case comes up on a grand jury. You leave the courtroom at that point after your preliminary hearing. And the next thing you know, you get someone that's charged, you get a card in the mail that says, hey, you got to appear in court on this date. And that's for your actual arraignment. And that means that you've been indicted. A grand jury is 18 people. At least 12 of them has found probable cause to believe that you've committed a crime, and they've issued an indictment against you. So then you go to court for your arraignment. Always plead not guilty at the beginning. You never plead guilty at an arraignment. So you plead not guilty. And then you go through the process of, your attorney starts talking to the DA's office and tries to see if there's some kind of a plea deal or looking at the evidence to make a determination if you're going to try your case or not. So that's in a nutshell how a felony case gets handled here.
Okay, so let's discuss objections. What kind of objections are made at trial?
So if you're at trial, the most common objection that you always hear, like when there's testimony being presented, the most common objection that everybody knows is hearsay. Well, so the question is, what is hearsay? Well, hearsay is pretty well everything. Anything that's said outside the court is hearsay. Now then, in the rules, and that's what you learn about being a lawyer, that's what you learn in law school, and really how you become a lawyer is, you have to determine, there are exceptions to the hearsay rule. So anyway, when somebody starts saying, they're testifying and they say, hey, well, I heard or so-and-so said this, whatever else, when that's the easy way you know it. Somebody says, hey, I heard whatever, then of course you object. Well, so Mr. Smith said, objection, Your Honor, you state your ground, and then that's a hearsay objection. So that's the main objection you hear. In criminal cases, and also with all the other cases, the next thing you do is your documentary evidence. You say, hey, they're trying to put something in evidence that just doesn't belong there. And the whole, it's not a technicality thing. I know that's what I always thought before I was a lawyer, and that's what a lot of people think. Hey, he gets off on a technicality, or he got his case dismissed because of technicality or whatever else. The idea in a trial is to get as much truthful information as you can to a jury so they can determine, hey, so they can have enough truthful information. So if there's a piece of paper, and I have this question all the time, somebody says, hey, can so-and-so write a piece of paper and sign an affidavit and file it? You know, file it in, and can we have that introduced in evidence? Well, the answer is no, because, you know, what Danielle might want to write in this case and say about something, well, jury only hears one side of the story. You know, the state or the defendant doesn't get to ask you questions, doesn't get to cross-examine. So that's why those documents can't get in. For instance, police reports, they're not admissible, because that's the officer's observation. And you can't just go up and say, here's this police report and here's what you need to consider. Well, you know, you're going to see one side of the story. You can't cross-examine a piece of paper. So that's a lot. That's the evidence usually that you try to object to make sure that what they hear is the truth, that these people have knowledge of it. They know what they're talking about and testifying to. The other thing is, is actually the evidence that's collected, the DNA evidence collected, or the pictures taken, or the test results from a bloody cloth or some drugs or whatever else. You know, that's the other objections. You sit there and say, all right, this piece of cloth was collected. Okay, what, once this officer picked up this piece of cloth from this scene, what happened to it? You know, who all touched it? Where did it go to? Which lab did it? Is this stuff reliable? You know, should the jury hear this stuff? So that's the kind of objections that we make. I mean,
yep. Y'all have a call, by the way, from Alicia from Coleman. It's on the phone.
All right, Alicia, what's your question?
Yes, I have a question. So if you have a judgment in a divorce, and it's not child support or alimony, but in the divorce she was awarded an amount of money and they stopped paying, what is that? Are they in contempt of court, and what do you do to carry them back to court if they're behind, say, $18,000?
The good thing, I mean, you can file a contempt. You know, if you file a contempt, it's what, it's $350 filing fee. So it costs you money up front. But when you file a contempt against the other person saying that, hey, they're willfully not doing it, an issue you face is that other person, I'm going to say this is your ex-spouse, I'm going to assume it's your ex-spouse, they have to come to court and say, this is the reason I'm not paying. You have to prove that they're willfully not doing it. If that person says, hey, I've lost my job, I've lost this, I've done this, I don't have the money to do it, then they're going to probably slide out of that contempt. You still have a judgment. The best thing that you can do to collect on a judgment is to number one, file it with like the probate court, so that what you do then is you have a judgment that you're putting out there that puts everybody on notice. Hey, I've got a judgment against Bob Smith here. It's $18,000. So when Bob Smith tries to borrow money for a mortgage, or Bob Smith tries to sell some property or transfer property, he's got this $18,000 judgment he's got to deal with. So that's number one, is make sure you got a judgment filed. The second thing you can do is, since you've got a judgment, you can take it to the clerk's office. Pay the fee for garnishment, which I believe is just $21. It's not that much. Fill out the garnishment papers and go to Bob Smith's. If you got Bob Smith's employer, you can send it to his employer. His employer, if he gets served with that, and Bob Smith, and he's paying Bob Smith the money, he's got to take that money out. He's got to take money out of his check each week. And if you know Bob Smith's bank, whoever he banks with, then you can also file a garnishment, and then whatever money he has in the bank on the day that garnishment served on the bank, they'll withhold that money. They'll pay it into court, then you have to file a motion for the court to, it's called condemn the funds and pay them over to you. So that's the best way to collect your judgments. File it so that they can't get money or they can't sell property. File something against where they work at so that you can collect money from their wages. And third of all, if you know where they bank at, hit the bank so that whatever money's in the account gets taken out that day. That's the best way to collect on a judgment. And the good thing, Alicia, is that this is a divorce judgment, so they can't file bankruptcy on. If you remember, I'm assuming, Josh, when he talked about bankruptcy stuff, there are certain debts that are not dischargeable. And at one time, it was just alimony, and maybe the child support payments wasn't. But I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that the courts has come now and says, look, if it's anything from a marital, like a divorce settlement, whatever else, they can't discharge it in bankruptcy. So that saves you. That means you've got a good valid judgment that you can collect on, and you got 20 years to collect on that judgment too. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
All thank right, you,
yes,
Alicia.
Ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Thanks. Bye bye.
Bye bye. So on that judgment. Okay, let's go there just a second. I know it's a little off base, but I got to go there. So when they go to garnish the wages, what a percentage of that wage can they garnish?
I think some stuff's 25%, and I think some stuff's up to 40%. But I know it's at least 25% of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're fixing to take a break. Thanks for hanging in here with us with Understanding the Law. I'm filling in. And hopefully doing an okay job. You can call in at 256-737-9505 with any legal question for Melvin. He'll be sure to answer it. We'll be right back with Understanding the Law with Melvin Hastings.
Hey guys, let's face it, we all want to look our best, but with minimal effort, right? Well, that's where Angela at Scissor Salon comes in. She'll get you looking your best, so you're always on top of your game. Walk-ins are always welcome. Scissor Salon, Highway 278 East, just past the water plant, 735-3089, 735-3089. Look for the big scissors on the roof.
Attention Coleman business owners. You are the people we want to hear from. All of us here at Live 95 want to take a moment to remind you of what life was like before Live 95. Yeah, so we don't want to go back to that. This is just a friendly reminder that Live 95 can help you. If you're a new business just getting started, or a well-established large business, Live 95 can actually help you get tax breaks on your tax bill.
Woo-hoo!
Hey, we're not kidding. Seriously. Send us an email at studio@live95coleman.com today, or visit our website, live95coleman.com, and click on support to find out more right now. Do it. Thanks for listening to Live 95. We're Coleman's independent radio.
You've thought about it. You've talked about it. You've even stared into the mirror dreaming about it. Well, now is the time, and Coleman Sports Fit is the place to get that body you've been wanting. Shaping Coleman since 1989, Coleman Sports Fit offers free weights and Cybex machines, treadmills, stair steppers, ellipticals, and an indoor track. Want to get wet? Take a swim in the indoor pool, whirlpool, or steam room. Coleman Sports Fit offers a variety of fun group classes too, like spinning, muscle pump, Zumba, cardio sculpt, or dance fit. Plus, Coleman Sports Fit has the area's only racquetball courts. And for seniors, Coleman Sports Fit is a proud provider of silver sneakers and silver fit, a seniors only exercise plan at little or no cost. Coleman Sports Fit Wellness Center, Highway 31 next to the Ag Center. For more information, visit ColemanSportsFit.com.
Here's a new Live 95 suggestion on how to prepare for the new work week. On Sunday night, you cook dinner. You help the kids finish their homework. You scream at your husband. You take the trash out. You make sure your kids brush their teeth. You tuck them in, sigh loudly, then pick up your remote control and turn on Sunday Night Live on Live 95. It's like being at a music festival, but without the illegal vapors, bright lights, and rednecks around you. However, if you want to make it more authentic, you can pour beer all over yourself. Sunday Night Live, all live tracks from 9 o'clock until midnight. Right here on Coleman's independent radio station, Live 95. Welcome back. Live 95 is Coleman's independent radio. You're listening to Understanding the Law, a show taking your questions about how the law affects you. A show that is a deep discussion on the most common topics that come up in a law office and how the system of law works right here in Coleman County. If you have a question about the law, give us a call here at the Live 95 studio at 256-737-9505. This program is made possible by the support of local Coleman attorney Melvin Hastings. Views and opinions presented on this show are not the views and opinions of Live 95 staff or management. You should independently verify information heard on this program yourself. And now, once again, here's your host for Understanding the Law, Big D, Daryl Netherly.
I'm far from Big D. Do I look like Big D?
I look like Big D.
I have gotten the name Little D for some reason.
And people. we got to get his name right. It's Nethery.
I hate that. I want it to change. Every time I listen to it, I'm like, I hate that. He does not have an L in it.
You know, I was just kidding about the butterscotch candy, and here we got it today.
Don't be kidding about it. Dean missed it last week. He really did. He missed it. Yeah. And he gave me a hard time about it, too. Abby, you want some candy?
You know, Abby just asked me a good question, and she caught me off guard, and I'm going to have to look it up. She asked me about bullying. She asked me if that's a crime, and I know there are bullying statutes in other states. I'm sure there is one in probably Alabama. It probably deals with school bullying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what's a juvenile, if a juvenile does something wrong, it's not called a crime, it's called a delinquency. It's not like a regular criminal procedure. You go through the juvenile procedure and you don't file a complaint like you do in a criminal case. You file a delinquency petition saying this child is delinquent. That's why, important tidbit of information. That's why you don't have to disclose, that's one of the reasons you don't have to disclose your juvenile adjudications, because they're not crimes on applications. So here you are, you fill out an application, trying to get a job at Walmart. Let's say you got in trouble for some juvenile delinquent act, whatever it was. Maybe you was out rolling yards or something, got charged with criminal mischief. So that act is not a crime. If it was an adult, it would be a crime. But since it's a juvenile, it's called a delinquency. And you're not really found guilty. You're adjudicated. You kind of adjudicated guilty of the delinquency, not of a crime. So you can take a Walmart and say, "Have you ever been convicted or charged with a crime?" Your answer is no, because first of all, it's a juvenile case. They don't have access to it, and you have the right to answer no to it. You're not lying about it. But the biggest thing is, and probably the most technical thing that people don't realize, it's not a criminal act. So when they're asking you if you've ever been charged with a crime, the answer is no. Now, I don't think there's any employers going to ever ask you if you've ever been charged with a juvenile delinquent act or whatever else, because I just don't think they'd be permitted to do that. So that's how you can keep that out. And then you have youthful offenders, too. A youthful offender is someone that's between the age of 19, or it says over the age of 18, and 21, but you're less than 21. So you have that little window. If a juvenile or someone, I guess they're really an adult, then gets in trouble, they can request to be youthful offender. And if they get youthful offender status, then it's treated like it's not a crime. So that's something else. You do not, later on in life, you don't have to disclose that you got arrested for it, convicted of whatever else, and it's hidden records. It doesn't show up if they do searches.
Does it affect your ability to get into the military?
Yes, I think it does.
So the military has the right to ask you that question?
Yes, apparently they do. I've never just like dealt straight up with them, with the military on this, but I know they're really strict, and I know that I have a lot of 17, 16, 18-year-old kids, maybe even 19-year-olds that comes in and says, "Look, you know, I'm in trouble for this," and it may be something, you know, not very, very serious, but, you know, pretty minor, but it's enough to get them in trouble and get a delinquency case, and they're worried because they found out that the military, you know, won't accept them for these type of charges. So apparently, I guess the military does have access to maybe some records that the normal public doesn't have.
So even a small crime such as harassment or any type of domestic would prevent that young person from
that becoming... That is a hard question to ask. I mean, hard question to answer. It ain't hard to ask. It's hard to answer. I just don't have the knowledge of it. I know that there are some stuff that really affects people getting in the military. I know that because they get serious about it, and they come talk about it. So usually what we try to do in that case, if you got someone, and it used to be this, and it probably still happens. I don't seem like it's happened here lately, but if a kid got caught, it's like with marijuana, something like that at school. They're 17, 18 years old. They'd come in, they said, like, I want to go in the military. You know, that was their way of getting out of trouble was to go in the military. So, and used to be, it didn't matter whatever they was charged with. They could be charged with robbery. And then, you know, they'd come in 18 years old and says, look, I made a mistake, whatever else, but I want to go in the military, you know, and you eventually say, yeah, I see what's happening. You got yourself in trouble. You've heard that, hey, I can go in the military and get myself out of this. And it depends on the crime. A lot of time, the prosecutors right here, if someone's serious about it, they do have some kind of recruiting letter that they're serious, and you know they've been maybe in the ROTC program or they're doing something to get in the military. A lot of times, they'll give them an opportunity. They'll give them, hey, you do community service, you do this, do that, 6 months, you don't do any you don't have any problems with you, do all this stuff. We'll dismiss your case. But you know that's usually the first or second offense. If this is someone who's been in trouble a lot, They don't get that type of a break.
So we were discussing criminal procedure earlier. I want to know the difference, and I want the audience to know the difference between a grand jury and a jury of 12 people.
All right. The grand jury is the ones that's 18 people. They meet there. I think they come in on maybe in January of the year, and I think they either meet three or four times a year. I can't remember. It's once every 3 months or once every 4 months. So it's either three or four times they meet a year. And those people hear the cases, and what on the only thing that they hear, the only thing is the prosecution's case. The defendant don't know about it. That's why I'm saying you won't ever know when you're indicted. Because the DA is in total control of the grand jury proceedings. They decide which cases go and when. I mean, it's so secret. I don't even know how it even operates. But I mean, I know whenever it happens, and I can see what happens. You get all these police officers and investigators up at the courthouse. So I assume what happens is they'll call a case, the investigator or the police officer that made the arrest or did the case will go in there, show his evidence, talk to those, you know, ask the prosecutor will probably ask him questions, and then the grand jury can actually ask him questions. So I think the individual jurors will ask him questions. And if they're convinced that, hey, there's enough stuff from what they've been told, only one side of the story, then they'll issue an indictment on them. So that means that there's a charge. It don't mean you're guilty, but there's a charge, and then you're going to be ready to go to the next procedure, which is what you're talking about, the jury of 12 people. That's your criminal jury. I think they call it a petit jury or something like that. A PETIT jury. I don't even know what they call it, but that's the actual one that's going to determine your fate, guilty or not guilty.
So when the indictment's done on a grand jury, does it occur in the same county?
Yes.
Can it be moved?
You talking about
when it goes to the grand jury, when you have enough evidence?
Yeah, it has to be in the county where the crime occurred at. Yes. So they'll do it in the county where the crime's committed. Now then, once they've issued the indictment and a person has, you know, you have, that's when you have the arraignment after they've been indicted. There'll be a court date. You'll actually receive a copy of the indictment, or your attorney will receive a copy of the indictment, and then that person will go up there, and like I said, you either plead guilty or not guilty, but everybody, every judge says plead not guilty now. You come back on a plea docket later on if you're going to plead guilty to the case. So you plead not guilty now, then what can happen, and it's rare, you know, everybody says, hey, I want to change a venue. Well, it's not. You have to have a legitimate reason to get a change of venue. And it's tough. It's always capital murder cases. or it's maybe some really high profile case.
Then
you know,
what would be some of them examples for it to be moved?
Well, the last one that I can't remember any Coleman cases here. I would imagine if it is a, for instance, I don't know that this has ever happened, if one of our judges got in some serious trouble, you know what I'm saying, then that case would probably get moved to a different county. That would be, it'd be something rare like that. The last case that I remember that sticks in my mind of a case that's moved is Robitelli, whenever he was charged and convicted of murdering a woman and like two of her kids, and it was a horrible case out of Marion County, I think it was. I don't think it's Winston County. I think it was Marion County. But it got moved over here to Coleman because there was, everybody knew about the case because it was just horrible. I mean, it was a horrible fact situation. So his lawyers argued that, hey, there's no way, you know, too many people know too much about this case. It would be hard to get a jury of 12 people that don't know something about this case, you know, that doesn't have some type of a relative involvement, or they just hear all these stories, it's been on the news so much, whatever else. That's the type of stuff when you do a change of venue. You know, but for his case is crazy. Coleman's really, really conservative. We know that. You know, Jefferson County is not as conservative. So if I'm charged in Coleman County with a crime, I want to go to Jefferson County. If I'm charged, Winston County and Marion County is real conservative. If I'm charged with a crime like he was in Marion County, I don't want to go to Coleman because you're not gaining anything. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? He wanted to go to Birmingham where you have a better chance with the juries. I mean, it's just the difference. That's why it's called a jury of your peers. It's where you live at. You know, and Coleman's just, we got a reputation. I know it. I mean, I tried numerous cases here. I'm not saying it's bad or good or whichever. There's just a really conservative jury here, and, he didn't fare well anyway coming to Coleman. So that would be how you change the case, but it is extreme. Everybody, they get mad. For instance, you know, I've had it this year. I can't remember any particular case, but I've had people come in and say, I want to change the venue. I want a different trial in a different county. And really what they want is they want a different judge, number one, because they've done been in front of this judge before and they don't like the judge. The number two thing is they don't like the DA, you know what I'm saying, because he's been hard on before because they've been in trouble. So they think, hey, if I get a different county, I'm going to get a different judge, which is not true, and which may not be true, and I'm going to get me a different prosecutor, which is not true. The only thing you're gaining is a different jury. For instance, I'll go back to Robitelli case. The judge in Marion County, which was Judge Adderholt, came to Coleman and tried that case. So the only thing that Robitelli gained out of that case was a Coleman County jury. The Winston County prosecutor, the Marion County prosecutor, it's all one circuit. He came over here. The judge came over here. All he had was just a different jury.
So as an attorney, how do you guys pick the, or gals, how do you pick the jury?
You know, we call it striking a jury. And striking and picking is the same thing. You don't actually get to pick who you want on your jury. When you're striking a jury, you're picking who you don't want on the jury.
Okay, so it's like a process of elimination.
That is exactly what it is. And if everybody understands that is because you can't go in and say, hey, I want juror number one, and then the state says, hey, I want juror number two or whatever else. So what happens is you'll get in a typical criminal jury week, and we've got one coming up June the 12th, there'll be 70, 80 jurors show up. Every once in a while, it'll be over 100. There'll be 80 people that are chosen, that's got summons to come to court. So they'll show up, and at one time when we had two judges here in the criminal cases, the jury would be split in half. One judge would get one would get the other. Now I think they all just stay with the same judge, which is Williams now, that does the criminal stuff. So you'll have 70 people in there, and the judge will ask them specific qualifying questions. Some people shows up for court, like, for instance, for jury service, and they moved in Mobile. Their license, which I assume is how they get summons, the license still show that they're in Coleman because they had, you know, they just got the license renewed last year and had them renewed, but they recently moved to Mobile 6 months ago. To be a Coleman County jury, you got to live in Coleman County. So the judge will ask that question, hey, is anybody here that's not a resident of Coleman County? Well, somebody will raise their hand and they'll say, look, I just moved to Mobile. Well, that person's automatically disqualified. They've been struck off by the court because they're disqualified. There's other, for instance, the court will say, hey, are you related to this defendant? You know, it doesn't happen a lot, but every once in a while, I mean, I've had a couple of mine where, you know, someone says, yeah, that's my cousin, that's my brother-in-law, whatever it is. So that person is disqualified. If you're related to the district attorney, if you're related to the defense attorney, they're automatically disqualified. So once you get all the automatic disqualifications off, which are just very few, you get them off. There are some people that are dismissed from jury service because maybe they're really elderly. They got some real sickness. Some people are dismissed from jury service. They go up and ask the judge to be dismissed from jury service so that because they got a job, because they're a single parent, got kids, got a lot of issues. So there's usually a few of them out of that 80, maybe 10 people that are dismissed. The remaining 70 will be who you pick the jury from. And, you just ask them questions. You know, you ask them, common questions are, do you know anybody in the DA's office? Do you know any of the witnesses that's going to testify? Do you, you ever been a victim of a crime? If I'm a person that's charged with a burglary, the last person I want on my jury is someone that's been a victim of a burglary. You know what I'm saying? Because they're probably pretty mad, you know, and they may, I'm not saying they won't be fair, but it's likely that they're going to have some bias. So that's what you're doing. You're trying to get in these people's lives and see what it is. So you strike them off. You say, when it gets down to striking time, you say, all right, defendant don't want that juror. State says, I don't want that juror. You don't ever know the names. You just use the numbers. And you just keep on striking until you get you 12 that's left.
Well, I think we're going to go to commercial break is what it sounds like. We'll be back with a little bit of more of Melvin. With Understanding the Law.
Attention Coleman business owners. You are the people we want to hear from. All of us here at Live 95 want to take a moment to remind you of what life was like before Live 95. Yeah, so we don't want to go back to that. This is just a friendly reminder that Live 95 can help you. If you're a new business just getting started, or a well-established large business, Live 95 can actually help you get tax breaks on your tax bill.
Woo-hoo!
Hey, we're not kidding, seriously. Send us an email at studio@live95coleman.com today, or visit our website, live95coleman.com, and click on support to find out more right now. Do it. Thanks for listening to Live 95. We're Coleman's independent radio.
Hey guys, let's face it, we all want to look our best, but with minimal effort, right? Well, that's where Angela at Scissor Salon comes in. She'll get you looking your best so you're always on top of your game. Walk-ins are always welcome. Scissor Salon, Highway 278 East, just past the water plant, 735-3089, 735-3089. Look for the big scissors on the roof.
You've thought about it. You've talked about it. You've even stared into the mirror dreaming about it. Well, now is the time, and Coleman Sports Fit is the place to get that body you've been wanting. Shaping Coleman since 1989, Coleman Sports Fit offers free weights and Cybex machines, treadmills, stair steppers, ellipticals, and an indoor track. Want to get wet? Take a swim in the indoor pool, whirlpool, or steam room. Coleman Sports Fit offers a variety of fun group classes too, like spinning, muscle pump, Zumba, cardio sculpt, or dance fit. Plus, Coleman Sports Fit has the area's only racquetball courts. And for seniors, Coleman Sports Fit is a proud provider of silver sneakers and silver fit, a seniors only exercise plan at little or no cost. Coleman Sports Fit Wellness Center, Highway 31 next to the Ag Center. For more information, visit ColemanSportsFit.com.
Welcome back.
Live 95 is Coleman's independent radio. You're listening to Understanding the Law, a show taking your questions about how the law affects you. A show that is a deep discussion on the most common topics that come up in a law office and how the system of law works right here in Coleman County. If you have a question about the law, give us a call here at the Live 95 studio at 256-737-9505. This program is made possible by the support of local Coleman attorney Melvin Hastings. Views and opinions presented on this show are not the views and opinions of Live 95 staff or management. You should independently verify information heard on this program yourself. And now, once again, here's your host for Understanding the Law, Big D, Daryl Netherly.
That is Daryl Nethery. Thank you. This is Danielle with local attorney Melvin Hastings. I'm filling in for Big D for a couple weeks.
We got Abby in the house, too.
Abby,
of course.
Beautiful Abby. She's just our new graduate.
Was just me and Joe was just talking about her. He had commented that she's really dedicated. She comes up here on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Drives all the way from Hartsville. She's my girl. I love her to pieces. She does a great job. So we've explained how we do the jury strike, Melvin. Pick and choose, so on and so forth, what qualifies and what does not. And I'm not supposed to say that, by the way. Thanks, Daryl. Anyway, so let's talk about plea negotiations.
What happens pretty well everywhere, it's not obvious. I mean, well, you know what? Now that I think about it, there may be something in the statute that says, I'm reluctant to say because I don't know it for sure, but I almost think there is something in the statute that says that the state should, I don't know that they have to, they should enter into plea negotiations with any defendant. You know what I'm saying? To see, hey, is there something that we can do that can be done to serve justice, because what everybody wants, their justice served, and to punish this person without having to go through the whole process. Because could you imagine the indictments? I don't know how many they probably return now. They probably, each session is probably 75 or 80, but I know 10 years ago there'd be 150 indictments come out, you know. And there's no way, when you have a criminal jury week five times, six times a year, if that much, probably four or five times a year, that you can process that many cases. So every one of them gets some kind of a plea negotiation. And the way it happens here, and pretty well, like I said, the way it happens everywhere, is the district attorney's office will look at the history. They'll look at the criminal history of that person. They'll look at the crime. Most of the time, they probably talk to the victims and talk to them about their case, you know, and that gets real emotional because, you know, if I'm a victim of a crime, I'm going to get pretty mad. So you try to, you know, give them the pros and cons of going to trial and stuff like that, and you try to work out some type of a deal. So the DA, the district attorney, will send us a plea offer. They'll send us all the discoveries, what it's called, that we're entitled to, the police reports, the statements that people made, the pictures, the any evidence they had sent off to forensics. They'll send us that, but then they'll also send us a plea offer, and they'll say, hey, this person will plead to this offense, then we'll offer them this sentence. Now, sometimes, okay, let's go back, because we've been talking about burglaries. Maybe this person's charged with burglary first because they broke into an occupied dwelling and they had a knife or a gun or had some kind of a weapon with them. So the DA will either say, hey, he can plead to burglary first, we'll offer him 10 years, which is the minimum, and he can apply for probation. Well, what would happen is if that person accepted it, then they're going to get a 10-year sentence. They're going to plead guilty to get a 10-year sentence. They're not going to get probation. I mean, they're going to apply, but the judge is not, I mean, realistically, it's not going to give them probation. They're going to have a 10-year sentence, and more than likely, because it's a violent crime, burglary first, they had a weapon that was used, you know, to affect the crime, they're going to serve seven and a half, 8 years of that sentence. You know, so depending on the situation, you know, what I do as a criminal defense lawyer would say, look, why can't we plead to burglary third? Why can't we plead to burglary second? Why can't we plead to an attempt to commit? Because an attempt to commit a burglary crime, any crime, it makes it lesser. So it would knock it down, you know, a whole notch, and you get a different sentencing range, and you try to, You know, if you say, hey, can we plead them to a burglary second and let them get a five-year sentence? You know, or five and apply. Sometimes the DA says, well, if they agree to a five and they say five and go, and what that means, you agree to plead guilty to a five-year sentence and you ain't applying for probation. That's like I said, you're probably not going to get it anyway. You get a five-year sentence and go. But that is a significant, even though the 10 years and the 5 years is only, you know, you're cutting it in half, that's significant. But the more significant thing is you're pleading a burglary second. I'm saying it's probably not. I don't know how the DOC classifies it, the Department of Corrections, but it may not be a violent crime. There's nothing suggests that there's a weapon used. So even though that person's got a five-year sentence, they may go to jail for a year and a half, 2 years. Or go to jail, go to prison for a year and a half, 2 years, and they're out. They're not having to do the whole 3.5, 4, 5 years sentence. So that's kind of how the pleas go. The state usually doesn't offer what they'll go down to. You know, like I said, they maybe the whole time they're thinking, well, we'll let this guy plead a burglary second, but they'll usually come to us, hey, if he'll plead a burglary first, we'll give him the minimum sentence and he can apply for probation or he goes on to prison. Then that kind of leaves it up to whoever's representing the guy that got in trouble or the girl that got in trouble. Hey, why don't you let him plead a burglary second? Why don't you let him go to burglary third? And that's kind of how we negotiate it. We negotiate them. A lot of times we go over there to the DA's office. I'll call John or Jeff, whoever, and say, hey, look, on so-and-so's case, I said, if you got a few minutes, can we talk about it? And they'll say, yeah, sure, come on. So we'll go over there. They'll show the evidence. I mean, I've not got the evidence, but they'll show us the evidence. They'll say, hey, look, this person's been in trouble before. Or they'll say, hey, this person hadn't been in trouble before. We'll get him the benefit. He did something really stupid or she did something really stupid, you know. And, you know, when we try to sit there and say, well, look, there's on, you know, and a lot of times it is, there's on drugs, they're just doing stupid stuff, they made a mistake, you know, they got a job, they got kids, they got this. So, you know, what we're trying to do is, hey, I want you to consider this person's, you know, how does it affect this person's life or whatever else, and try to get them to, you know, most of the, you know, and then a lot of times we talk about the weakness of the case, you know, just because someone's charged and you got a police report and they think they got this evidence, you know, sometimes it's hard to prove it in trial, you know, and that guy that's guilty as heck of burglary first, maybe there's something that's lacking that they can't prove that he's the one that did it, even though everybody knows he did it, you know, and the state has to come down and say, look, you know, instead of taking a chance of getting a not guilty verdict on this, we'll let him plead to burglary third and get probation. Well, a lot of times the victims are jumping up and down, they're mad about it, but you know, you just have to tell them, hey, look, you know, it's at least you're getting something out of it. If he gets found not guilty, it's over with. You know, you can't get a retrial. Once someone's found not guilty, that case is done deal. You can't, you know, state can't appeal it. State doesn't have a right to appeal it. The case is over with, and that person's discharged. So that's how all the pleas work. Most of the time you're trying, I mean, of course you'd like to get the case dismissed, but if it's got up to the circuit court level, it's going to be impossible to get it dismissed. Then you're working on. So the next thing you're trying to work on is say, all right, can we get it reduced? So it's not the same crime they're pleading to. Is it a lesser offense? And then you're trying, hey, can we get them on probation? Can we do something with probation where they don't have to do a jail sentence?
And will you explain to them the probation, usually the guidelines to probation or revocation of probation. Yep. And then once they've done the revocation, there's also a thing called diversion.
Yep.
So I want you to touch on them just a little bit.
Well, what happens is 2 or 3 years ago, Alabama kind of fell with all the other states and the federal courts and developed minimum standard guidelines, which says prosecutors don't like it, though, but they say, hey, this person's committed 1, 2, 3 prior felonies or misdemeanors or even counts traffic violations. They've committed these things right here. The crime he's charged with is a possession case, possession of drugs. His prior convictions are possessions of drugs, whatever else. And you get points for that, and you add up the points, and at the end, I mean, it's mandatory now. I mean, the judge has to follow them. For a little while, like 4 or 5 years, we had these guidelines. They was kind of for the judge to consider the guidelines. He or she did not have to follow the guidelines. If they decided not to follow the guidelines, they had to state in writing why they didn't follow the guidelines. But 2 or 3 years ago, when they did this prison reform bill that came back, they changed it, so now it's mandatory. So if a person, I think it's 1 through 16, if it 8 and above, is automatic prison. 7 and below is automatic probation. So if that person gets a 7 and they've got, you know, they've been in and out of jail and trouble all their life, and they've got possession cases and stuff like that, and they've had cases dismissed and everything else, it doesn't matter. When that score adds up, if it's below 7, then they automatically get probation. Judge has no discretion. You know, and that makes people mad, but, you know, that's the way it's set out. But most of the time, we're talking about the crimes that are in these guidelines are property crimes. They are drug crimes. Most of them are drug crimes. Burglary has been added, but it's the one where you break into not a dwelling, break into a building. It's not occupied. There's nothing really major. I mean, other than you getting into somebody else's property. Burglary is added. I don't know if identity theft they added it or not. Stealing someone's credit card information, which, you know what, if I'm a victim, I'm mad and I want this person to go to prison. But it's one of the guideline offenses. They add up numbers, and if they don't go above a 7, they automatically get probation. Now, it doesn't say that it has to be supervised or unsupervised. That's up to the state. Sometimes the state will say, Judge, we recommend that, or the state say, hey, if he'll plead guilty, he gets we want him to have supervised probation. Means you got to meet your probation officer every month, or we want unsupervised probation, which means you don't have a probation officer. You don't meet them every month, but as long as you fulfill your obligations, then you're fine. You know, you're not violating probation. Now, then, if you get a sentence that's above 8, then you go to prison. I mean, that's the way it is. Now, then. There's also something you said a minute ago. It's called community correction, or it's called diversion, prison diversion. Commonly called community corrections here. We call it diversion community corrections. Mm-hmm. We know it's all the same thing. But what happens then is that's for someone that is either didn't get the probation sentence, they got a prison sentence, or it's for someone that's been on probation, that's done wrong, that's either got in trouble again, that hasn't paid their... hadn't been reporting, hadn't paid their fines. They've done things to violate their probation. They've done something serious. The judge has gave them their warnings. The judge has then put them in jail a couple times for sanctions. They just don't learn their lesson. So that person can apply for community corrections. Now then, if you're granted that prison diversion of community corrections, what that means is you're still a state inmate. You still go to prison, but instead of actually going to prison, you serve your time outside of prison. You have an officer that's assigned to you, community corrections officers assigned to you. You have very strict guidelines. You have curfews you have to be at. You have to be where they can call you any time of the day or night. You have to work. You have to live. You have to live at a certain place. You can't be around other felons. You can't do this. You can't do that. You're subject to random searches, random drug screens, and stuff like that. It's probation, but it's a little tougher probation. And the thing about diversion is you're still an inmate. So if I'm someone that's on prison diversion, I decide I'm going to go to Florida, you know, and stay down there for a week or 2 weeks or whatever else. If I don't let my community corrections officer know, and he's probably not going to let you anyway, but unless you got a really legitimate reason to be there. But if I go and leave, or if I don't report, then I'm an escapee. I'm an inmate that's escaped, and they can charge you with escape. So now you got a new felony on you. So you're on probation, essentially. It's tough. You get in trouble. You get a new felony. It's escape. You lose all your good time. So when you go to prison, if you plead guilty on the escape, you're not getting out early. I mean, it's you're going to serve most of your sentence. So it's it's tough. It's not without its... it's good. You know, people, if you get in trouble, you go to prison, they always say, hey, man, can you get me diversion? That's what I want. You know, and the court system is really, I mean, they allow it. Some court systems allow it, and some judges allow it a lot more than others. Some people aren't eligible for diversion. You know, if you've got a prior sex offense, you're not eligible for diversion. If you charge with trafficking, you're not eligible, like trafficking in drugs. You're not eligible for diversion. Of course, if you got, you know, murder or something like that, some things are not eligible for diversion. If you got other cases that are pending, you're not eligible for diversion. So
on the diversion, also you are obligated to be at a hearing. Is that not correct?
Yeah. You're talking about
when you apply for diversion, and
yes,
you're going to be yay or nay whether you're going to receive diversion is done in a hearing process.
Yeah, you can, a lot of times it is. I mean, every once in a while you file. Most of the time what happens is seriously on diversion is this. Someone's on probation, they've been in trouble, okay, and they got in trouble again. Or someone's been on, someone has got that 8 or 9 or 10, they're not up to the 16, they got to go to prison. So what you do is just as look, I can't grant you probation, or they say I'm going to revoke your probation. So this person is going to prison. So you file you get with the community corrections people in Coleman, for here in Coleman, and you ask them, hey, can you get me a letter that this person's qualified? So they'll do a background check. They'll say, all right, this person is not a sex offender. This person doesn't have violent crimes in the past. This person doesn't have any new cases pending anywhere. No holds. No arrest warrants out anywhere. And then they'll send you a letter and say, yes, this person's qualified for diversion. And then you'll file that with the judge. You file reasons why they should get diversion, talk about facts and circumstances of the case. Yeah, a lot of times the judge will have hearings and tell them about it. Sometimes just the motion the judge granted. So,
well, we're going to come back with some more questions for Melvin. You have a question, please call in at 256-737-9505.
Actually, it's 7 o'clock.
I should say it's probably pushing at 7 o'clock. It goes by
that
fast.
Went by fast. This is my first time, Melvin. Yeah.
That's what happens when I don't turn on the TV for you.
So. That's right. See, I didn't have the clock, so I didn't know. I apologize. Y'all, come back and be with us on the Big D Radio Show Thursday night at 6:30. Look forward to seeing you there. God bless. Thanks, Melvin. Appreciate you.
Appreciate you. Thank you, Danielle.
Y'all have a good evening.
Broadcasting from the People's Bank of Alabama studio, from a transmitter as powerful as a hairdryer. Hey, we got it on high. This is Live 95, Coleman's Independent Radio. WRJMLP, Coleman.